It's the Digital Rights Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, crazies get polled, the Scottish Atheist, PBO and You, and digital media rights and wrongs. Let's begin episode 207.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your... What am I this week? I guess I'm going to be a skeptical political scientist and a philosopher. Why not?
Something you almost sort of pulled a Rob there and went for like ice cream taster, skeptical... psychologist, magician.
You know, actually, yeah. See, but I don't want to steal Rob's thunder, right? Yeah. But every week we sort of say the same intro and just spice it up a little bit would be kind of good. You know, Ethan, I don't know if you heard about this. We were going to do a little segment this week about de-extinction and extinction of animals, and maybe we'll do that next week. But, you know, there's an animal that's about to go extinct that has been integral, interconnected with human life for thousands of years. It's on the verge of extinction. Can you believe it? Have you heard about it, Ethan?
Is it plankton?
No, it's much more personal than that.
Polar bears?
No, it's pubic lice.
Oh.
Apparently because it's become a popular trend to shave down there, we're destroying the ecosystem of the poor pubic lice, and it's on the verge of extinction in many parts of the world. I know. I heard one campaign to save the pubic lice from extinction.
Really? Save it, eh?
Well, to be fair, it was on the Jon Stewart show, and they may have been, you know, being a little funny. But, you know, speaking of being funny, there's been some polling lately that have been, like, almost as much of a crazy idea as that.
Well, Don, you're alluding to, I guess sort of a very interesting headline that's been popping up. 12 million Americans think lizard people control the U.S. of A.
Wow. How did they ask 12 million people that question?
Well, see, that's a good question. Actually, it was a poll conducted by the Public Policy Polling, or the PPP, an American polling company, which did political season right now. They phoned up a bunch of people and asked them some questions about conspiracy theories. So very interesting for us skeptics. They surveyed 1,247 registered American voters from March 27th to the 30th, and they conclude that there's a margin of error for the overall sample of plus or minus 2.8%. This poll was not paid for by any political organization. It was purely just sort of a, you know, for...
Actually, it's a marketing stunt. As you point out, it's kind of a slow season, right?
Right.
But they're coming into, you know, their election cycle starts up again next year and all that sort of thing. So one thing that polling companies will do is they'll have these sort of outrageous, ludicrous sort of polls that everyone clicks on. But at the same time, it's, you know, the PPP. So later on, Ethan, if you wanted to do some polling for the radio station, what have you, you'll think, well, who could I call? Oh yeah, there are those people that did the crazy poll, and so it's not entirely innocent, but it is
fun. Yeah, it is fun, and it also is kind of interesting in a sort of scary kind of way. They talked about conspiracy theories, and what's interesting is that they were able to catalog these not only sort of based on like how many people actually believe these conspiracy theories, but also where they fall on the political spectrum. So. For the top, sort of the top five most believed conspiracy theories in America are not too surprising. The biggest one was that JFK was killed by a conspiracy. which I guess he kind of was, actually. I mean,
one way or the other.
51%. The next biggest one was that Bush intentionally misled about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. 44% of Americans believe that. The next biggest one, kind of a sad one, they believe that global warming is a hoax at 37% of Americans. Next is aliens existing at 29%. And rounding it out is the belief in sort of the New World Order at 28%.
Now, you know, it's interesting you bring that one up, because one of the complaints I had methodologically with this is how some of the questions were phrased. So, for example, the one that you just sort of mentioned, the actual question states, do you believe that a secret power elite with a global agenda is conspiring to eventually rule the world through an authoritarian world regime? Yes, it's called corporatism, and I would have said yes to that. Now, do I think it's some sort of Illuminati and there's a bunch of guys in dark rooms? No, but I mean, what exactly qualifies as a power elite? You know, the Koch brothers and that sort of thing, those are kind of secretive guys, and they sure. do a lot of, right? Of course, most people on most of these conspiracies said they didn't believe in this conspiracy. But another one that I thought was interesting, again, and it depends on how you read this, is do you believe the government adds fluorine to your water, not for dental health reasons, but for other more sinister reasons? Now, on the one hand, you could read that again, ooh, they're trying to poison the people or something like that. But then again, I might sit back and say yes to that, not because I think that there's some sort of plot. But, you know, it's one way that we always say the government tries to give money to corporations. So maybe this is just one way for a corporation to make some extra money by selling the government to put fluoride in the water. So it's sinister, as in you don't need to have it in there. And the only reason why we're doing it is to make profit off of it.
Mm.
But, you know, I did find some of the numbers quite interesting. I mean, you mentioned the most confident yes numbers, you know, people who are most into that. I thought it was even more sad in some ways that a lot of people were unsure. And I think that's also quite compelling to tell. And the most unsure number I came up with was that Roswell alien cover-up, which was at 32%. But the number one was autism linked to vaccine, which was 34%,
yeah.
Which really shouldn't be that big of a I'm not sure.
It goes to the, I guess, sort of the manufactured controversy around some of these conspiracies, that the question of them in of itself is alarming for people. I think it's interesting how it broke down by political lines. So, for instance, 34% of Republicans and 35% of independents believe in the New World Order threat, compared to just 15% of Democrats. Obviously, only 12% of Obama voters think that global warming is a hoax, compared to 61% of Romney supporters. So more than half of people who voted for Romney believe that global warming is a hoax.
Well, and it's even worse than that, because as far as did Bush lie about Iraq, it goes to 72% of Democrats mm-hmm. versus 13% of GOPers.
Yeah, and in fact, there's only a couple, there's about five or so conspiracies that I guess you could say Democrats believe more than Republicans. One of them is that the government allowed 9/11 to happen. Now, it's not specifically clear on, you know, who orchestrated it, but basically just there. I mean, you could even interpret that as government accountability. But 13% of Democrats believe that, 8% of Republicans. One, that the CIA spreads crack in inner cities.
During the 80s. It's important.
Yeah,
sure. This was Reagan. And, well,
yeah, no, that
makes
fair enough.
Totally different.
17% of Democrats believe that, 10% Republicans. They're tied at 28% on aliens existing, which, I mean, that's not even that surprising. The one about Bush lying about weapons of mass destruction, 69% of Democrats believe that to be true, 18% of Republicans. The fake moon landing, 6% Democrats, 5% Republicans. So very close on that one.
One of the things I thought was funny, and I must admit I heard this first on the SGU, but again, where party affiliation seems weird, that 6% of Democrats think that Obama is the Antichrist.
That is weird, isn't it?
Worse than that, or better, depending on how you put it, 4% of those people who voted for Obama thought he was the Antichrist. Now, either A, they're trying to pull a Bush here where, you know, the best way to get rid of government is to elect the Antichrist to destroy it. But seriously, what the hell were people thinking about Mitt Romney then? I mean, if they're willing to vote for the Antichrist over Mitt Romney, where
well,
does that
you know, maybe it's because maybe they're buying into this notion of they want the Judgment Day thing to come, and so they need the Antichrist to come along, just like they want Israel to become its own sort of nation thing, because they want
Israel is its own.
Well, nation. You know what I mean. They're looking at the biblical prophecy that Israel will return, etc. So maybe it's like that kind of thing.
I thought it was interesting that that of the questions, the not sure averaged about 20%, but on the lizard overlord theory, that actually had the lowest. It was at 7%. It was also the most confident no answer, as in I think 88% said no.
Right.
That said, people who identified as either very liberal or very conservative, their yes number was over 10%. Oddly, those who identified their race as other were at 21% believers.
Hmm.
So they're like twice as likely to believe, also they're twice as likely to believe that Paul McCartney died and was replaced in the 60s, maybe by a reptilian.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it actually makes sense because, you know, if you factor in the age part of it, if you look at the age, young people are 13 times more likely than old people to think that lizard people are real. I mean, think about it. If you're wearing a disguise, right? I mean, you're obviously going to look quite young. And of course, what race are you going to put down? Well, you're going to put down other because, I mean, you're a lizard, so you don't really fall under the standard ones. So maybe what this poll really has discovered is that there really is a reptilian plot to take over the world. And this is just outthought them by bringing up these poll numbers. You know, stats can...
Yeah. The real question, though, is that if it meant having some form of the Beatles back, would you be willing to accept an all-reptilian Fab Four?
Yeah, except for when they had to, you know, peel their skin. That would be kind of a... Yeah. Although, you could probably sell that on eBay.
Probably, yeah. There's lots of... Okay, well, why don't we take a quick here commercial break on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back with more after this.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So Ethan, I don't know if you know this, but a couple of weeks ago, the first and likely the last parliamentary budget officer ended his term and it was not renewed. And the PBO, it's parliamentary budget, sounds a little nerdy, but it's really kind of important to democracy. So I thought maybe we should cover it a little bit on the show, just so people are aware of sort of what it is, what's at stake, and why they should care. For those who don't know, Kevin Page, who was the PBO, a longtime conservative, former friend of Stephen Harper, a member of the Prime Minister's office, was appointed by said Harper to stand as Canada's first PBO officer, and he stepped down a few weeks ago. The PBO was a campaign promise of the Conservative Party and the brainchild of Harper. The Conservatives and other parties were constantly complaining that the then previous Liberal governments were fiddling with the budget number to win elections and make themselves and their ideas more palatable than what the real figures would have led one to believe. The PBO was envisioned to be an independent office that could crunch the numbers and provide Parliament with an objective, nonpartisan analysis of government budgetary items. It was to ensure and provide open and transparent reporting. It was to be able to define its own research agenda while simultaneously responding to incoming requests from Parliament and committees. So it was allowed to basically free rein to investigate any part of the budget that it thought, hey, this could be important. Let's see if the numbers really work out. Shortly after winning his minority government, Harper enacted his dream in the Financial Accountability Act. He then appointed Kevin Page as Canada's first PPO officer. Page stepped down a few weeks ago, and it looks like there will be no replacement. Why, you may ask? Well, it seems that Page took his job seriously, and Harper realized that a good idea as opposition may not look so good when you're in power. The PBO made waves when in 2011 it provided an analysis of the F-35 jet fighter purchase that showed that the true cost would be more than three times as expensive than what was reported by the department. His numbers showed that a cost of $29 billion plus $4 billion for upgrades, while the official numbers pegged it costed only $9 billion. Along with the damning report by the Auditor General that also pointed out the F-35 selection process was not based on tendering process, as it should have been, well, the Harper government had to backpedal. So for now, the F-35, they're saying they're going to revisit the choice and they're going to entertain competing bids. Needless to say, a lot of egg on Harper's face. The PBO last year released an analysis of the projected costs over the next 7 years of benefits to elderly. It concluded the cost would rise for a number of years relative to GDP, but then fall back very close to current levels. This report contradicted the government statement that the old age security was unsustainable. Again, a meme you hear a lot on the conservative side. And if you think about it, I mean, there's going to be a bit of a bump in old age security as the baby boomers reach that age, but they're also going to disappear from the old age security as they literally die off. So it always struck me as a weird one to peg your hat on. The office has also released reports questioning Harper's numbers on things like the crime bill and other legislation, again, essentially being a bit of a thorn in the dogmatic Harper side. One of the biggest points of contention was his inability or the delays in getting access to necessary information from various departments. Here we go again with the Conservative government wanting to keep not only the public, but in this case, our elected representatives in Parliament, in the dark. In performing an analysis into the 2012 budget, the PBO was faced with a number of large government departments that refused to disclose the numbers of job cuts and how much services in each department would be affected. Major ministers, such as Flattery in Finance and Clements in the Treasury Board, have outright refused to cooperate, stating that the PBO was going beyond his mandate. The PBO is actually divided into two divisions, one for economic and fiscal analysis, general economic and financial analysis, outlooks, and sort of risk assessment, how is things going in the future. The other is expenditure and revenue analysis, which is directly tasked with analyzing programs' cost estimates, assessment of budgetary systems, and providing cost estimates to parliamentary proposals. Essentially, this is exactly what they're supposed to be doing. MPs have complained while defending the PBO that it's very hard for them to vote on a budget when the budget doesn't actually say what it's going to do. I mean, for example, Flattery says that he's going to reduce Fishery and Oceans Canada budget by 5%. Well, what exactly does that mean? Well, it could mean they'll switch from disposable coffee cups to reusable ones, or it could mean that they're going to shut down the Environmental Lakes Area project, which has been running for over 40 years. You might say okay to the first one, but I suspect many MPs would not have said yes to the latter. The PBO argues that it's his job to inform parliamentarians and the public about what a $5.2 billion cut will do to the government and has gone to the courts to gain access for the required documents. Another aspect that Page is fighting for change was where his office sat in the government hierarchy. The PBO is attached to the Library of Parliament. Although a library, it's not a public one, or only at least selected amounts of it are released to the public. As such, anything that the PBO publishes could be labeled as secret or the librarian's equivalent, and thus neither the public nor the non-executive parliamentarians would actually have ready access to what he's reported. On top of that, under current legislation, the position was appointed by and works at the pleasure of the Prime Minister. A private member's bill reflecting the recommendations of Page was to make the PBO independent, directly reporting to Parliament, and appointed by a non-partisan parliamentary committee. It should be noted that the interim head of the PBO is the parliamentary librarian, Sonia Haru. On this appointment, Page commented that Haru, as a librarian, reports directly to the Speaker of the Senate and the House, again, further questioning the independence of the particular office. He also noted that as sort of the budget watchdog, she's never actually ever worked on a budget, and that this sort of sends a strong signal that they don't want somebody acting in a position that actually knows what they're doing, that they actually have knowledge and experience in the area. quote, if the government wanted to send a strong signal that they wanted a true legislative budget officer, they would have appointed somebody on an interim basis from within the office. Instead, they are looking for someone who is, quote, tactful and discreet and achieves consensus, good at achieving consensus. So sort of my last word on this. If we had a minority government, it would be possible to change the legislation to make the PBO a true pillar of democratic governance. Those who complain that minority governments are bad should take a look at what happened in the last couple of years under the Harper government, ask themselves, if given the chance, would you have changed your vote?
Hmm.
So I guess, having said all that, the big takeaway here is that governments will often say one thing, but when it comes time to actually do it, the details can be really, really important. I mean, quite often they will sit there and they'll say, for example, we're going to restrict certain chemicals that are allowed to be used for pesticides. What qualifies as organic? We had that on the show before. But outside of saying we'll define it, it then goes to a smaller committee or it goes to a department where they actually weed out all the nitty-gritty. And quite often, it's the nitty-gritty that's where the meat of the issue is. As I pointed out, to sit there and say you're going to cut Transportation Canada, a food inspection agency, right? Oh, no, actually, the best one, just recently, that's been in the news, is Revenue Canada, right? They're cutting funding to Revenue Canada, but they say they're increasing the number of people who are going to be investigating fraud. Well, those two seem contradictory, and that's where the PBO would go in there, and he'd say, well, so how exactly are you going to do this? What are the details? And provide that information to both the parliamentarians, who are important, but also to the public so that we know what's actually going on.
Well, you know, it's interesting as well because you mentioned how there's different sort of departments and there's a question of how much autonomy do these departments have within the government. And it strikes me that our government, the way we structure it, is designed to give a lot of autonomy to the individuals working in a department so that depending on the personality of the person in charge, you may have a very secretive department or a very kind of fly-by-night kind of whatever goes. And it just sort of seems that this is a very inefficient way to run a country.
Well, again, one of the things that, you know, all sort of Westminster democracies have as a detriment is there's a lot of power invested in the executive.
Mm.
And the executive is essentially unaccountable. I mean, it's supposed to be accounted to Parliament, but that's kind of devolved because if you vote against the executive, you've essentially kicked yourself out of a job. So now it's just sort of rote that you just do whatever they say. But what's leading into a greater secrecy, as you pointed out, is that, you know, even people who are in the government don't even kind of know what their own government is doing. I mean, we've been having a lot of stuff in the news again about backbenchers who are complaining that either they're being dictated to by the government or they're being told to keep quiet about item A or item B. And these are the people we've elected to do our job. The whole point of representative democracy is to have someone who represents us, who's informed and who knows what's going on. And as you point out, one of the things that would prevent against what you said, so let's say I'm Minister of Transportation, and in my department, one of myself or my minions somehow managed to do something that destroyed air traffic in Canada. Well, in theory, at one point, I would have to go to Parliament and say, hey, listen, planes don't work in Canada anymore, right? Sorry about that. And I'd lose my job. And it's that I lose my job part that's meant to keep me accountable. But another change that's happened over the last few years, I won't say exclusively with Harper because it was kind of coming in before that, but it's definitely a change over decades ago, is that ministers were really accountable for their departments. If they did something or their department did something, they fell on their sword and they went off into the sunset, so to speak. It's usually career-ending sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's like, hey, guys, sorry, we screwed up, but hey, I've got a new idea just down the road. And there's no longer that idea of accountability. We're losing accountability in our government. And one of the things that the PBO, the Parliamentary Budget Officer helped do was to keep government accountable by saying, hey guys, they said this, but this is really what's happening. It makes you accountable and why it's so important.
Mm. Why don't we go to a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker and be back with more after this.
This guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Freethinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Freethinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
This is Phil Plate of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So, in today's day and age, with the internet being the great equalizer that it is, it's becoming increasingly difficult to protect intellectual property from piracy. So this could extend to illegally downloading music, games, movies, TV shows, and the like.
Ethan, that's all fallacy. Nobody does that for real. That's just some sort of conspiracy enacted by our government in order to trample on our rights as individuals.
Do you have a statistic from the PPP to back that up?
No, but I can make one up.
Okay. Well, in order to counter this threat, distributors of such content have taken to including protection or piracy prevention tools, usually referred to as DRM, Digital Rights Management. Now, we've actually talked about this on the show in the past, and we've mentioned how some DRMs have pretty serious consequences for the property they protect. So, in essence, some of these rights will actually prevent you from, say, moving the content that you've purchased from one medium to the other. You know, if you, say, download an album on iTunes, it can be very difficult to move that album to a different medium, whether you want to, say, move it to your iPod or burn it to a CD so you can listen to it on your CD player if you still have one of those.
CD who?
Yeah, exactly. But what's kind of spurred me on to think about this again is two interesting news items that have surfaced in the world of digital media. Now, one of them might be kind of a sore point for Don, so we'll have to be gentle when we discuss this, but it is the debacle known as SimCity. So, SimCity is the latest city-building game produced by Maxis, which was released to great fanfare, only to have its servers promptly fail and prevent millions of people who bought the game from playing it for weeks. So, SimCity had what was known as sort of an always-on DRM system that required you to be online for the game to work. This would obviously prevent piracy by requiring the game to be in constant communication with the Maxis servers. However, they didn't anticipate that so many people would log on at once, and once the game launched and they all logged in, it crashed, and there goes the servers.
Crashed is a bit of an understatement.
It is. To call SimCity a failure is kind of an insult to failures everywhere. The company had to request people stop buying the game, Amazon refused to sell it, there were problems with people trying to return the game, and game reviewers who couldn't actually play the game had to delay their reviews. In some cases, they reviewed the beta version and then had to go back and alter their score. It was basically a huge embarrassment, and, you know, Twitter and social network lit up with people complaining about the game, and it was really only inflamed when several Maxis employees, some of them anonymously, admitted that the always online option wasn't necessary and was basically a big mistake. And then, in fact, some hackers found out that you could disable the DRM and you could still play the game online, or you could still play the game, you just couldn't play it online. And that the whole justification for including it was basically nonsense in the first place. So, I mean, Don, you were a victim of this because you excitedly bought the game.
I did. I was so hyper. I mean, I don't buy games, right? I don't really buy much of software at all. And this is why, right? But, you know, it's very interesting what you said. There's actually been some very interesting court cases south of the border about media rights. And for reference, you know, more and more, soon all copyright laws will be dictated sort of by international treaty. So what happens in one country will have an effect in all of them. The first case was about a guy who purchased a bunch of textbooks in Thailand and then shipped them to the USA, where he sold them to university students. I guess books are cheap there, and well, we all know that textbooks here can be almost as expensive, if not more expensive, than actually your tuition will be. Anyway, the publisher of the books sued, saying that you couldn't resell them because it's copyrighted material. The courts came down on the side of the shipper and not the publisher by making reference to something that's called the doctrine of first sale, which simply states that, you know, once the rights of the copyholder essentially are exhausted after the first sale. So you still have the copyright, as in I can't just, you know, reprint the material anywhere I want or anything
or
like
claim that.
That
it's mine or something.
Exactly. So, I mean, that aspect of it. But the actual book itself is no longer your property. It is my property. And as such, you no longer have any rights to dictate what I do with it because it's now mine. Now, this this doctrine, like I say, only really applies to resale. But, I mean, essentially, that's all we're worried about here today, right? You know,
right.
It's this sort of idea of what am I going to do once I have it. Well, the second case involves a startup company called Redigi, which set up a sort of secondhand record shop. People who owned legal digital copies of songs could resell it to another. Like any sort of secondhand product, the selling price is usually noticeably cheaper than what the original selling price was. They dealt with media from iTunes, Amazon, etc. Redigi would delete all the copies of the song from the seller's computer, transfer the song to their own servers where it would go on for sale. Then the copy of the song, would go to the purchaser's computer and then be deleted from the server. So essentially, there was only ever sort of one copy, so to speak. But so that was the idea, and they were doing pretty good with this. Lawyers for the publishers, though, explicitly say that they are not selling, but actually renting. So unlike the old days when you bought something, no, you're not bonding, you're leasing, which is why it's called a lease agreement or renting. And even if it was a sale, technically the song is a reproduction, i.e. a copy from one computer to another, and therefore a copyright violation. That is, that it therefore is not reselling of the original, but really a new digital copy. And of course, if you deal with digital media, I mean, it kind of has to be a new digital copy. Even moving it on my own computer from one location to another technically is creating a new digital copy. In this case, the courts came down on the side of the publishers and explicitly stated that the doctrine of first sale was inapplicable in this case. This goes against the European Court of Justice ruling last year that stated that it indeed was permissible to resell software, even if the digital goods were downloaded directly from the internet, and that the first sale doctrine applied whenever software was originally sold to a customer for an unlimited amount of time. So if I bought a song and essentially would be mine in perpetuity, forever,
right,
then I could resell it to somebody else and that would be legal rights.
So the other reason that I wanted to bring this up was another sort of social media phenomenon, and that is the nerd-loving show Game of Thrones is back on TV. And the insanely popular HBO series that recently returned for its third season, the first episode set a record for the most illegally downloaded thing of all time. So you think, you know, of course HBO is going to be flipping out over this, right? Turns out they're kind of not. So I'm going to quote from the HBO programming president, Michael Lombardo. I probably shouldn't be saying this, but it is sort of a compliment. The demand is there, and it certainly didn't negatively impact DVD sales. Piracy is something that comes along with having a wildly successful show on a subscription network. So here's an interesting question. Why would HBO, I mean, they're producing a very expensive product. It's not like Game of Thrones is cheap to produce. They got all these actors and sets. And you'd think they would want to drive as many subscriptions to their premium cable service as possible. Why would these two companies have radically different approaches to piracy?
Well, you know, I think essentially this lies into what I would call sort of a fundamental fallacy that downloads kill business, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, to be fair, you know, as I say, I cried a lot about SimCity, right? It has scarred me forever, and as I say, I will never buy software again, I'm sure. But that being said, I mean, in the past, you know, I would download and I would sample software, but it's not like stuff I would have bought anyway, right? I was just sort of playing with it for a couple of days, and then I would delete it. And ultimately, it kind of comes down to the idea that there are two sort of people who kind of buy stuff, right? There are the people who buy things because it's something they really, really want and they have to have, or they're just sort of plain lazy. So where I was going with this idea is there are some people, you know, who are willing to spend the time to go out and find their show and download it and then watch it. But others just want to open up iTunes and click and play. When digital media first hit the scene, it was not, you know, it was not competing with online sales, but it was in store sales. You had to go to a store to buy stuff, right? It literally took a lot more time to go to a store and buy a game than to just sort of copy it from your friend who came over. But now that dynamic has reversed. The one-click online shopping means it's actually simpler to buy than to, what euphemism shall I use, than to borrow your software. Another aspect is fear. Most people are either worried about viruses or being sued, but mostly viruses. There's an impression that most people on the internet or computer users are skilled and knowledgeable. The truth is, most of them are like your mom, still afraid that if they hit the wrong button, a plane somewhere will crash. Those who have sort of grown up with the tech have already been conditioned to click and buy. And trust me, most kids are not as smart as we seem to think they are. I mean, lazy is the norm for all ages. So I agree with what that there's essentially it's a zero cost to piracy, at least in my view, and you can contradict me later if you wish. But most people who pirate were either not going to buy it in the first place, so you're not losing the sales. And for those few people who do pirate instead of purchase, by having more people sort of listening to what's out there, you're getting more people interested in it, and they'll be compensated by someone who gets into that, and they go out and they want to buy more of it, so they go out and they buy more of it. So essentially, it becomes a net zero sort of artifact. But that's my own opinion. What does the statistics say?
Well, interestingly enough, there was a study on this by the European Commission's Joint Research Center's study examining the effects of online piracy and digital music sales. And they found that piracy did not affect digital sales. So, interestingly enough, the research observed the online habits of 16,000 Europeans as they went on to various illegal and legal music downloading sites. Using Nielsen Clickstream data, the researchers were able to monitor internet users from 5 countries, Spain, the UK, Italy, France, and Germany, and their consumption of music. In terms of music, the study found that piracy didn't encourage more sales, but also didn't discourage sales either. So according to the research, pirates would typically illegally download music they would normally not purchase. So for example, if I was going to, say, try out a band that normally I would never buy their song, but okay, I'll try it out, see what it's like. Typically, I would not download my favorite band's music. I would go out and buy their CD. So it's not like piracy is hurting the diehard fan. Or I guess the piracy is not being used by the diehard fan. It's not hurting their favorite band. You could make the claim that it is hurting the once in a blue moon time when you download a band that you may in fact like, and you just want to sample their music instead of buying it.
But Ethan, we all know we're not really hurting the artists anymore. I mean, one of the things that I always put in the, well, I don't know if I put it in the back of my head, sometimes it's in the front of my head, is that, I mean, Maxim / EA Games, I mean, really, they can afford to lose a little bit of money on SimCity. I mean, it's not like that there are starving artists out there who would literally die if someone doesn't go out and buy their song. And when I buy from iTunes or from whatever, Sony's making the bulk of the money, not the artists themselves. So in that sort of sense, I don't know, I think I can, I don't feel as bad as perhaps I would have if I was literally stealing bread from someone's mouth.
Well, I think it is interesting how we do try to rationalize piracy. I mean, in the case of Game of Thrones, you have a product that is only available from HBO. I mean, you can't get it on iTunes or Netflix or anywhere else unless you want to wait, you know, the months for the DVDs to come out. So people say, well, I have no choice. I have to pirate the show. I mean, you could always just not watch the show, of course.
It's crazy talk.
Yeah, and this line of thinking has also led to rumors that HBO is actually going to consider basically making the episodes available on their own sans the subscription policy, which is also sort of an interesting move for HBO to make if they just decided to go down that route.
Well, actually, I thought I had heard, and someone may contradict me on this, that, what was it, House of Cards is actually being released sort of free. Like, they had it, you could get it instantly online, but instead of sort of doing the whole DVD release or whatever, is that they're just sort of saying, well, hey, if you want to download it, great, we're not going to kind of stop you, but we hope, you know, you'll come by and you'll pick up, you'll watch Showtime because this is what came from, and sort of using the sort of moral argument to get people to buy.
Well, that does seem to be an interesting form of marketing because the comedian Louis C.K. basically used this method to sell a comedy special he did where you could download the show for $5. It had no DRM on it. It was really easy to pirate and, you know, in theory, someone could have downloaded it, put it on, you know, the Pirate Bay and got it for free, but he ended up making over $1 million on it, and he continues to make money on it. So there clearly is a market for this kind of distribution. And he's not alone. Indie game makers use a similar philosophy. Many times you could sort of pay what you want, where you choose to pay 5, 10, 15, or nothing. And usually these game makers make enough to, they don't get rich, obviously, in most cases, but they sort of make enough to get by. Now, in contrast, companies like EA, which produce SimCity, they have no such policy. Likewise, companies like Microsoft or Sony or whatever are, you know, making a lot of money. So the rationale sort of becomes, well, these big companies can afford it if I steal their product.
Yeah, no, actually. And I think another aspect that comes to this is, I guess it partly deals with the game, because one of the things I loved about SimCity, the old version, mm-hmm. was the modding you could do to it, right? Is that you not only had the game, but it inspired people to come up with more stuff, and none of this was ever paid for. This was all free, unlike The Sims, where you pay, or the World of Warcraft, where you have to pay for anything add-ons.
Right.
This is just sort of an open source, hey guys, isn't this a great thing I made? Why don't you put it in your city? It's the idea of content sharing that builds upon itself. I mean, you get this a lot more in music than you do in the game field, but where you do sampling or you do a remake or a retake of an original song, and you either expand the audience, like, you know, that the hip hop version of I'm a cowboy or something, you know, like, you know, who would ever listen to the country version of I'm a cowboy? But you do the hip hop version and suddenly, hey, maybe it's not so bad. And you expand the audience or you add a new twist to it or what have you. That lots of times the idea of copyright isn't so much even to sort of protect the financial interests of it, but the exclusivity of it. And it's turned to actually be a retardation of the ability of expansion. I mean, especially with some of the rights nowadays. I mean, originally, copyright usually was something like 20 years or something like that. But now it's like the lifetime of the artist plus another lifetime after that, which just seems ridiculous.
Well, the funny thing is, and you mentioned the exclusivity of a product. One of the things that was common when the sort of the second generation of video game systems came out, you know, when you had the PS2 and the Xbox and et cetera, one of the big questions was, would these machines be backwards compatible? Would they be able to play the previous generation's games on them? And that was a big selling point, because if you amassed this huge library of PlayStation games, you wanted to still be able to play them on your PS2. But the rumors going into the next generation, we're talking about, you know, the next PS4s and the next Xboxes, are not going to be backwards compatible. In fact, they're going to have built-in systems to prevent you from playing the games you previously bought on your new system. And this is just a radical 360, to sort of be ironic, with the direction of video games, that they're trying to clamp down on your ability to transfer ownership of these things, physical games, mind you, to the next generation.
Well, and I think part of the rationale behind that, as the market matures, you get fewer and fewer sort of new people into the market. So when video games first came onto the market, you had like, you know, the 10% who owned them, but then you had another, you know, 90% that you were trying to entice to buy. Mm. But now you kind of have like, okay, everyone who's going to buy a video game console has probably bought it by now. So there's no longer sort of a growth market there. So when we release the next generation of games, how are we going to continue the inflow of money? If they get to use their old games, we sell the console, great, but then that's the end of it for a while, or it's just a trickle. So by forcing people to buy the new version of the game, they think, ha, I've got this great revenue stream. It's kind of the same thing about, you know, when you bought a stove or, heck, even sometimes to a degree, computers and that sort of thing, right? You kind of expect them to last years and years. But now if they last months, it's like, hoo-hoo, great. And they're to a certain degree, they're actually engineered for this, because you don't want to make them last too long, A, they say, because it becomes too expensive, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the rational. The more conspiratory, and I mean it's conspiratory, rationale is that if it lasts too long, then you're not buying a new one. You sell everyone their stove, then you shut down the factory for stoves because they all last forever. If you ever look at any of the advertisements from like 100 years ago, you know, they always stressed how long it would last and how durable it was. You don't see that anymore in any advertising that I see. Nowadays, it's like latest and greatest, and don't you want to get all the new stuff for it?
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, I think that video games are still kind of in that category of having a relatively longer lifespan. I mean, if you look at how long the Xbox 360 or the that generation's consoles have been around, they've been around for a good, 4 or 5 years. I think the interesting thing with video games too is that you're right, they've kind of tapped their market. You know, most people, it's not even a question of gaining new players, because most people play video games nowadays. That's the majority of it. And, you know, it's really the only way for them to really broaden that market is to go in such a bizarre direction. I mean, Nintendo is sort of the example. Instead of making sort of a classic system, they come up with sort of gimmicky products where it's like, oh, look, now you can play on your tablet, or now you can jump around and make the thing do, move around. And the only way for them to really gain new industry is by just sort of going in a very odd direction. And then you have its competition, of course, which is sort of the online, to a certain extent, mobile gaming industry, where you have companies that are coming up with their own sort of kickstarted consoles. The one example, the Android console thing, that's just sort of like, it's cheap, it only plays Android games, of course, but it's like, hey, this is a lot cheaper than buying an Xbox.
But even then, you get some weird things like the Chromebook, right, which I've just sort of been introduced to recently. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the one hand, yes, it's inexpensive, but, I mean, you're now locked into Google.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you have to do everything through Google. And somehow that doesn't strike me as expanding the market, really. I mean, it gives you a bit of choice. But the choice is either I can be locked in here or I can be locked in there, but everywhere I'm locked in, you know?
Yeah. It is true. I mean, it does sort of seem like we're not so much increasing the spread of different technologies. We're sort of just sort of concentrating them. You can either be locked into iTunes or locked into Google. It doesn't really...
Well, you know, I was watching a show the other day. It was talking about, you know, the future of science and all that. And they made a very interesting comment about patents, that there have been more patents filed since the year 2000 than have ever been patented in the entire history of patents before that, which goes back like 100 some odd years, right? And I was remembering, and we talked about on the show before, about how Google and Samsung have sort of this patent war going on. But part of the reason why they're having the patent war is they're trying to clamp down on the technology so that they become sort of exclusive market. So you'll have Samsung for all the people who don't want to buy or can't afford the big ones, and Apple will be the elite one for all of them. And they've essentially squashed out all the middle competition. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very interesting that Canada's... copyright law, I think this is the one that passed, although I must admit there's a lot of confusion about it, because bills come up and then they don't pass, but they're, is that your digital rights to your music and your movies and all that, right? You are free to copy them to any device or any medium you have. You own them and they are yours to do with as you see fit. But the only way to do that is to break the DMR. So the iTunes, for example, I buy a song on iTunes, I will put it on my Android phone. The only way to do it is to break Apple's DMR for iTunes so that I can copy it to my Android phone. Well, that software that does that is illegal.
Yeah.
Right? So you're allowed to go anywhere you want in the world. You just can't leave the house.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to bring this back to the question of piracy, it sort of seems like there is... It's sort of like a rock and a hard place here at certain points. The changing nature of the marketplace is pushing people to illegally downloading things. And I guess you can kind of trace this all the way back to Napster for letting the genie out of the bottle. How do you stop something without pissing people off?
Well, I think it's even more fundamental than that, is that, how do I put this? Before the 90s, maybe even the 80s, it depends how far I go back, everything we dealt with was real, right? I mean, if I bought a book, I got a book. But now we live in a world where everything is virtual or digital, and there is no longer any cost to making a billion copies of a song than it is to one. Whereas if you go back to the 50s, well, you had to make this, there was physically a lot of work to be done. That if I own a digital copy of a book, it essentially is immortal. Whereas the library, when they get a book, you know, they figure it's going to get like 500 or 1,000 loans, and then the book is going to be so decrepit they're going to have to throw it out. That we haven't as a species really made this adjustment that a lot of what we own is no longer real. It is virtual. It is digital. And we're trying to apply the laws, the copyrights, the ideas that, you know, seemed rational, logical, and justifiable in a sort of real marketplace to the virtual marketplace, and it no longer seems to make sense. I mean, for example, recouping one's cost on a digital song. Well, how many copies do you need to sell before you can say, okay, I've recouped my cost, right? I've got my 10% profit. Then really, after that point, there's no reason not to sort of give it away.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and in the past you couldn't do that with a lot of material because, like I say, you know, someone physically had to sort of come up with a lot of the stuff. What's even more scarier is there's a growing movement, growing area of the market of, I'm not even sure quite what the right term is, but you know, things like the Harlequin romances and certain detective novels are actually now being written, if I can use that word, by computers. You know, you give them sort of a basic parameters, and then it generates the whole yards. I mean, these are not works of art in any sense of the term, but I mean, you're gradually getting rid of the point where there's any benefit to having a copyright in them at all, other than to strictly say, I want to make more money off of you, and I have no justification for it, but why not?
Well, you've heard our opinions on piracy. What are your opinions on piracy? So let us know. Send us an email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Let us know. Are you illegally downloading our show? Or are you downloading it off of CITR? We want to know.
Yes.
And we're not going to persecute you for that, maybe.
Are we
going to
set up a paywall? That's the big thing these days.
Paywall. That's where it's at, I think.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the only downside, right? If you did set up a paywall and nobody paid, I mean, that would be kind of, you know, crushing, really.
Sorry. It would be a little crushing, yeah. Let's take one quick break here on the show. We'll be back with our skeptical highlights after this.
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the food bank, or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
The best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Empowered you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So it is time for our skeptical highlights. Don, would you like to go first?
Why not? I have three highlights, so to speak. Two of them are events. Philosopher Cafes, to be particular. On Wednesday, the 17th at 7 p.m., Mano Daniel, he has a BA from Dalhousie, a PhD from Waterloo, is going to talk about the benefits of cooperation. That's always kind of an interesting thing to talk about. He's going to talk about this at the Heritage Grill in New Westminster. It's free, so show up at 7 p.m. if you want to find out why you should cooperate. The other one is What on Earth? As we acknowledge that Earth Day 2013, what are the possibilities for more urban agriculture? What are its possible effects? They're talking to Randall McKinnon, who will be a speaker there, who will talk about, you know, hey, what can we do to sort of be more urbanly responsible with regards to agriculture? That's Friday, the 19th, at 10:30 a.m. I'm not a morning person, so I'll skip that one. The other one is totally off topic, although you may have to illegally download it, because it's, I believe, the BBC. It's a show called Plebs, P-L-E-B. It's about, plebs in ancient Rome. It's kind of a comedy. It's a little off the wall. It's probably something most of you haven't heard about, which is why I'm mentioning it, because I watched a few of the episodes back to back, and it made me laugh, and I don't usually laugh out loud at a show. So, especially with the one about the pornographic vase. I mean, seriously, that's a classic.
Sounds very Monty Python-esque.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay, well, my skeptical highlights, I got three of them here for you. The first one is Cafe Inquiry. To offend or not to offend, that is the question. This is happening Saturday, April 20th at SFU Harbor Center in room 1520 at 1 p.m. So the topic is rather relevant given recent discussions in the movement. Much has been written about whether or not criticism of religion or religious doctrine should be considered off-limits in public discourse. Some even refer to it as racism or bigotry. And how far should we be allowed to go in our criticism? And at what point does it slip into racism? So the cafe, as always, will include about 20-minute presentation followed by group discussion. Lots of fun. And again, April 20th at 1 p.m. The next event is CFI's monthly lecture. It's actually a panel discussion on the science of vaccines. This is happening Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m. in SFU Harbor Center, room 1700. The panel will discuss reasons why vaccines are one of the foundations of public health. They will take questions from the audience on the creation of vaccines, how they work, and much more. In light of the recent anti-vaccination event, CFI hopes this will be an opportunity for science and science enthusiasts to shed some light on vaccines and provide some educational resources for the public. And finally, I want to give a shout out to the Imagine No Religion Conference, the third one happening in Kamloops, BC. The annual Atheist Skeptic Conference is happening May 17th to 19th, featuring a lineup of impressive speakers, including Dan Dennett, the, I guess, friendly horseman of the apocalypse, Richard Carrier, Chris DiCarlo, Taslima Nasreen, and more. I encourage you to register at imaginenoreligion.ca. And it's a great opportunity. It's got a great lineup. And the good thing is that it's a smaller conference. So unlike a TAM or a SciCon, where there's maybe going to be 1,000 people, you'll actually get an opportunity to hang out, have a drink or two with some of the speakers, meet some local skeptics and activists from your community. And it's Canadian. It's in Kamloops, Western Canada.
Yes, although isn't Kamloops in the right-wing kind of Christian part of the province?
Well, you know, it's funny because it seems to attract a lot of people. So I guess maybe feeling embattled, atheists will congregate more thoroughly.
You know, this is not quite a highlight, but it's something that might be interesting. People keep their eyes open. Now, we all heard about the horrible thing that happened in Boston with the Boston Marathon bombings, right? Mm. And, of course, Alec Jones was like seconds after it happened, said, oh, it's a false flag operation by the government, and that he's now being pilloried by the media for pointing out what the government's doing. But I did see an interesting tweet from apparently the Boston Globe or something like that before it had happened, that's saying that they were going to have a bomb exercise. And now there's lots of rumors going out, well, maybe this was just an exercise that had gone horribly wrong. So I'm not saying that it was. I'm saying it's probably a nut job still that did it. But it'd be interesting if anyone knows any more information, if they let us know at Radio Free Thinker. And, you know, not all conspiracies are true, but then some could be.
Well, I think that an important aspect with any kind of disaster like this is, you know, remain skeptical and don't assume the worst. I mean, we can very easily say, oh, this is going to be, you know, a terrorist attack, but we don't know. It could end up turn out to be some just crazy person with a vendetta for some reason. So, you know, let the facts filter in and use your critical thinking skills.
Exactly. In fact, there was already a panic that apparently some Saudi person was sent to a hospital because he had burns, and he was the one thought. Whereas he was just in the crowd, and he got attacked, and he happens to be Arab, and it's just people are quick to jump on things.
Well, this is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
To the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.